Unite our hearts in prayer together.
O God our Father, who hast revealed through thy prophets that happy is the man that findeth wisdom and the man that getteth understanding, we remember that thou hast declared that wisdom is more precious than rubies, and that nothing we may desire canst be compared unto her. In wisdom thou hast founded the earth, and by understanding thou hast established the heaven. O God of truth, ever beckoning man to loftier understanding and deeper wisdom, we seek thy will and implore thy grace for all who share the life of this university, knowing that unless they build amongst us, unless thou buildst with us, we labor in vain who teach and learn. For those who with a great sense of dedicated purpose struggle through the years that there might be here established these facilities, wherein the fount of wisdom might flow forth, we give unending gratitude. For the men and women who have here labored together faithfully through the years, that they might for their students bring together fact and vision, glorious paths and hoped for dreams, we raise our heartfelt thanks. And now we do invoke for these thy students, commencing as they do to meet life with minds made bright in the presence of the lamp of knowledge, with talents more keen through the presence of thy Spirit, the ever-abiding knowledge of thy will and purpose for their lives. Grant, O God, we pray thee that they may have discerning eyes, continuing to pierce the veil of ignorance in the laboratory of life, rightly dividing the word of truth. Grant unto them, O God, we beseech thee, the discriminating ear, that which is not attuned to flattery, but that which hears the harmony of purpose in thy creation. For them, O God, we would pray a heart responsive to the needs of mankind everywhere, for their nation, for those whose blood has been shed that here they might have created a homeland of freedom. May it become the strong and stirring passion of their hearts to continue so to work that men everywhere might know the priceless liberty that sets men free to do thy purpose. And finally, O God, we would pray that their hands might be extended in meaningful service, that that which has illumined the mind, that which has stirred the heart and attuned the ear, might be coupled with a hand that goes forth in service. For to this end were we created, that we might serve thee to thy glory, and for our fellow men. To this end, O God, do we pray that these might be our purposes in this and every day. In the Master's name we pray. Amen.
Welcome to the 40th commencement exercises of the University of Alaska. Each year, my office receives numerous congratulatory messages and expressions of goodwill, both to the graduates and to the university. This year, of course, is no exception. There's one that I have just received that I would like to read as representative of the many. Dear President Wood, to you and the members of the faculty, I send my compliments upon the noteworthy success of the academic year just completed at the University of Alaska. And through you, I extend hearty congratulations to each and every member of the graduating class upon his or her scholastic achievements signified by this year's commencement exercises. My greetings and congratulations also go to my esteemed friends and fellow Alaskans, Noel Wynn and Dr. R. Roland Armstrong, and to our distinguished visitors, Congressman Wayne N. Aspinall and Mr. Lowell Thomas Sr. Warmest greetings to all present. Signed, Ralph J. Rivers, United States Representative. Mr. Rasmussen, graduating class of 1962, and friends, the university. of Alaska. A century is a span of time long enough for an idea to be born, to grow up, grow old, and die. It was just 100 years ago, in 1862, that a gaunt giant of a man named Lincoln, as President of the United States, signed into law the Morrill Act. This law authorized the creation of what has become the land-grant college and university system in the United States. The impact of the idea, which was the genesis of a public higher education program designed for the youth of families working in industry and agriculture, has revolutionized the concept of higher education in the world. The idea has not died in 100 years. Today, it is central to our very way of life. It is alive, strong, and growing. Through its three-pronged thrust against ignorance, through instruction, research, and service activities, it has contributed immeasurably to the well-being of mankind. Nearly half of the persons of highly specialized talent needed to keep America vibrant and its economy viable are the product of land-grant universities. Numbered among these 71 institutions is your own University of Alaska. Always it is good to have a suitable occasion to recognize a landmark in the history of a great idea, particularly when one has just the right person to do the honors, as we have today. It is my good fortune to present to you a man eminently qualified to speak on the role of the land-grant university in our times. Wayne Norville Aspinall, a distinguished member of Congress from the state of Colorado, is a longtime friend of Alaska. All of us owe him much. From his position on the powerful and important Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs, he performed exceptional service in the cause of Alaskan statehood. He was a staunch and effective friend during Alaskans' long struggle for recognition. Through his quiet and effective statesmanship, he won essential support at a crucial moment to bring into being the 49th state of our Union. His deeds on behalf of Alaska are merely representative of his selfless devotion to great causes in the unfolding history of an enlightened and mighty nation, the United States of America. Proudly, yet humbly, I present an all-American, the senior congressman from Colorado, Wayne Aspinall.
President Wood, President Rasmussen, members of the Board of Regents, members of the faculty, honored graduates, members of the student body, and friends of the University of Alaska. To be able to return at this time to this great northernmost state of our Union is one of the most enjoyable experiences of my life. Not so much because of the honor which you show to me, which I assure you in all humility that I do sincerely appreciate, and for which recognition Mrs. Aspinall and I thank you, but rather because of the fact that I return after an interval of 11 years to find the people of this new member of our sisterhood of states enjoying their new status of self-government and meeting effectively new trials and problems, or may I say, the new challenges which confront them. At no time in the history of mankind has accomplishment of a feat performed, the enjoyment of a victory won, meant more than a temporary lull in the struggle which eternally confronts and belabors the progress of civilization. A short period only is our lot for a rest from our labors. Likewise, only an hour is permitted us to rejoice for the milestone reached. This is the lesson of history. Those who have rested or have rejoiced in the fruits of their victory for too long a period have seen civilization and progress pass them by and left them as wayfarers along the road. Defeat in their original cause would have dealt them no worse a blow. In fact, original defeat would have been kinder, because hopes would not have been raised nor ambitions kindled into flames of high resolve. So as I return for a few hours to this physical battlefield on which so many of you waged such a glorious and effective struggle, please understand that your friends and companions in arms from the other members of our sisterhood of states realize fully the many, the varied, the new, and the complex problems that now confront you in your new and full relations with us, as well as those responsibilities under our form of government that are peculiarly yours and yours alone. Keep in mind, if you will, that we wish to continue our help wherever and whenever it is in order and desired by you. It was clearly understood and recognized during the legislative struggle for statehood status for the people of this area that the achievement of such a status would not be a panacea for all of the difficulties which confronted the people of the territory. This understanding was within the knowledge of every clear-headed and intelligent worker and leader enrolled in the cause of statehood. The recorded history of each of the original 13 states, together with a record of each and every state since 1790, has laid out in detail the pitfalls and obstacles that went with full membership in the Union. Many of such pitfalls still remain as entrapments. Many of such obstacles still block the highway to public understanding and efficient government management. The perfect state, the perfect government, is still beyond the reach of man. And so it is, and so it shall be with our 49th state, the incomparable, and may I use the term, thinking of degree only, the unconquerable state of Alaska. Those who would rest after partial success, those who would reap without continual preparation of the soil and the sowing and the planting therein, those who would receive only, those who know not that the joy is, after all, in the struggle rather than in the victory, those of limited horizons and less understanding, all of such are of course not satisfied with statehood as we find it in Alaska, or for that matter as we would find it anywhere. Nor, in my opinion, would they be satisfied for long if their own temporary desires were satisfied. On the other hand, those who understand life and accept it as it is, those who are willing to work in order to delight in the succession of harvest, those whose greatest joy comes from the giving of their talent, those brave of heart who increase their strength by using strength, those whose vision is ever fastened on the beauty of the rainbow, those whose understanding accepts the limitlessness of knowledge and accomplishment, are pleased and proud with statehood. Their fondest hopes and ambitions are to make the new state more responsive to the need and the will of its citizens. Many of your pains may result from the recent labors, but I would rather think that they abide because of life itself, and that as long as there is life in your body politic, there also must be travail and trial. I congratulate you on your labor and on your victory. I commend you on the effective manner in which you have accepted and discharged your responsibilities. I'm proud of you, as are all of your understanding fellow citizens, in the humility with which you have received and accepted your newly acquired citizenship. May I add this personal word? Although my part was insignificant in comparison with those of your self-sacrificing patriots, and I leave each and every one of them unnamed at this time because time and facility does not permit the naming of all, yet I want you to know that I am exceedingly grateful that I was at least privileged to help a little. You have my pledge that I shall continue to labor in your vineyard for the preservation of self-government that is so precious to free men everywhere. And now, in the time remaining, I shall talk briefly about the outstanding federal education program which has engendered and sponsored such successful and effective universities as the University of Alaska. While I am sure it is really not necessary for me to define it, let me in the beginning state that the term land-grant colleges denotes a group of 68 educational institutions which were founded and developed under a broad federal aid to education program, the centennial of which is being celebrated this year. I am doubly pleased to have the opportunity to mark this celebration and this anniversary in the pioneer state of Alaska, where the United States still has a sizable remaining physical land area for development. The aspirations of our forefathers knew no bounds. They insisted on equal opportunity for education of all residents at primary, elementary, secondary, and finally higher levels, regardless of the social and economic background of such residents. The inability of the average resident to obtain an education beyond high school for his sons and daughters led inevitably to the entrance of the federal government into the field of what, for a better term, has been designated as higher education. The difficulty in obtaining entrance to college and paying for an education was just part of the problem. Apparently, another facet of equal importance was the emphasis that the universities of our early history placed on the theoretical rather than the practical. The people of the United States wanted to improve procedures in their daily pursuits and demanded opportunities for higher education in practical, everyday matters such as agriculture and the mechanical arts. Let me at this point make this observation. The first college in the New World was founded with public aid. The General Court of the Colony of Massachusetts in 1636, only 16 years after the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, authorized what now looks like a very meager grant of £400 for the foundation of a college. Thus was Harvard College established, even though later it was to receive its permanent endowments from private sources. Many colleges in our country's early years received aid of various kinds from state governments. The major effort, however, in the field of higher education came as a result of private action, some by religious groups. My own state of Colorado offers a good example, demonstrating the deep-seated desire of our forefathers to provide higher education. The first Colorado Legislative Assembly in 1861 authorized the incorporation of a university located at Boulder. However, it was the middle 1870s before the university was actually under construction. In the meantime, the state also authorized an agricultural college under the Land Grant Act, and it was opened to students in 1879. This school, located at Fort Collins, is today the Colorado State University. Basically, 100 years ago, colleges and universities, despite some public assistance, were private institutions, privately endowed and supported, reliant in part on tuition payments to meet their basic expenses. It is not surprising that endowments and other private funds were not adequate to meet the demands and needs of a growing population intent on obtaining for each person an education to the maximum of his or her ability. The parallel inability of the states themselves struggling to exist as practical entities made it inevitable that once again thought be given to the entry of the federal government into this field. Parenthetically, I remind you at this time that we always seem to have recognized the educated man as a national asset, and that our first president, in effect, so stated in his initial message to Congress, wherein he also suggested consideration of a national university. The first recorded public advocacy of a system of colleges founded on public support furnished by public land, however, is contained in a speech made by Professor Jonathan Turner before the Illinois Teachers Institute on May 13, 1850. His was a broad plan for a state university for the industrial classes. 6 years later, Congressman Justice Smith Morrill of Vermont introduced a resolution supporting a land-grant college system. This was followed by his land-grant bill on December 14, 1857. Without going into the details of the legislative history of the act, I would like to review some of the very pertinent steps which afford the lessons that only history can give. We know today that the land-grant college program is one of the exportable ideas for which the United States is known throughout the world, and particularly in the developing countries of today. Yet it took 5.5 years from the time that the first measure was introduced in Congress before it became law. Many of the individual actions on the bill were decided by narrow votes, some by just a one-vote roll call margin. The first time the bill was passed in February 1859, it was vetoed by President Buchanan, who made the first point that it would create a competitive situation that would curtail the federal government's income from the sale of public land. And to emphasize his point, he estimated that in the next fiscal year, the United States might lose the sum of $5 million, an amount that today is considered by many to be a satisfactory variable in any estimate of federal expenditures in a given area of operation. The second point of the veto message stressed the federal-state relationship, and in words that might be used today by opponents of federal aid to education, proclaimed, and I quote, "Should the time ever arrive when the state governments shall look to the federal treasury for the means of supporting themselves and maintaining their systems of education and internal policy, the character of both governments will be greatly deteriorated." The veto message then warned that the legislation would injure the newer states by putting vast amounts of their lands into the hands of outside speculators, be of doubtful assistance in the advancement of agriculture and the mechanical arts, particularly since the government would have no power to police the grants, and that it would permit the federal government to subsidize schools to compete unfairly with the struggling colleges and universities that had been established by private means. Finally, President Buchanan said, the bill violated the Constitution because, one, Congress did not have the power to appropriate money for education, and second, the right of Congress to dispose of the public domain did not embrace the right to give away the public land. So we see that 100 years ago, there were those who would not open up the frontiers of knowledge, just as some in 1962 refused to permit those frontiers, now open, to be broadened in order finally to assure education to the maximum of each person's ability. 3 years after the veto, in 1862, when the Union was facing an uncertain future in a war between the states, the Congress voted its confidence in the ultimate survival of this nation, and despite the Civil War, took the courageous action of passing the land-grant bill, which President Lincoln signed into law. Once again, in a time of struggle and trial, a constructive and forward step was taken. The Act of July 2, 1862, made available to participating states donations of public land, a portion to each state on the basis of 30,000 acres for each senator and representative in Congress, with the objective that these lands would provide a financial foundation in each state for the, and I now quote, the purposes of the law: endowment, support, and maintenance of at least one college, where the leading object shall be, without excluding other scientific and classical studies and including military tactics, to teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanical art, in such manner as the legislatures of the states may respectively prescribe, in order to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions in life," end of quote. Let me point out another way in which times have not changed too much, or in which history does repeat itself. The passage of the Act in 1862 was made more certain by providing, as stated in the quoted objective, for the teaching of military tactics. Today, too, we find that a defense posture for a measure gains some votes, and quite often in the name of education. In 1863, three states, Iowa, Connecticut, and Vermont, accepted the terms of the Morrill Act, even though two of these states, Vermont and Iowa, had already opened state institutions to students prior to that time. Every state has come into the program, as did three territories, of which two are now states and the third a commonwealth. There are today a total of 68 land-grant colleges made up of 20 separate colleges of agriculture and mechanical arts. 32 states are territorial universities that were either established or further developed as a result of the Land-Grant Act, and 16 agriculture and mechanical colleges originally set up for Negroes throughout the South. One additional Negro college has not retained its status as a land-grant institution. Along with Hawaii and Puerto Rico, Alaska prepared for its participation in the fabric of United States life by establishing a land-grant college. The University of Alaska, which was started in 1915 and opened in 1922, accepted the terms of the Morrill Act as a full participant in the land-grant system in 1929, and stands today as an important milestone in the struggle on the road from an outpost territory to full statehood. In the 40 years of its operation, the university is the only institution of higher learning in the territory, trained those who led the crossing of the frontier into a full partnership with the other states of the United States. I submit that the land-grant colleges have played an equally important role in each of the other states and in Puerto Rico. Even though the initial emphasis in the original Act was in agricultural and mechanical arts studies, the fact is that the land-grant Act, by its very terms, encouraged a much broader, more liberal education for all. No review of the College Land Grant Act would be complete, in my opinion, without a word concerning the charge of giveaway, a word which we hear so often. President Buchanan's veto message in 1859 had a comment concerning the right, or rather the alleged lack of Congress, the alleged lack of a right of Congress to give away public land. But this was no giveaway. I have had occasion recently in connection with the Homestead Act Centennial Observance, and will take every opportunity given to me to emphasize that the pattern of land laws requiring development in return for land involved no giveaway. This is how our nation grew, and this is how our nation prospered. The inducement of the act I've been discussing was to offer lands in return for the establishment of institutions of higher learning designed to bring practical and liberal arts education to all Americans. To achieve the resource of an educated populace, we utilize the resource we have, land. That the act succeeded is evident from some rather staggering statistics. Only 18% of all college students are enrolled in the 68 land-grant colleges and universities. Nonetheless, we find that these institutions award approximately 40% of all the doctoral degrees in the United States. In addition, the majority of the living American Nobel Prize winners hold degrees from these institutions. We have degree holders from land-grant colleges in positions of responsibility in industry as well as government. And although there's been an effort to focus attention in a different direction, you should know that half of President Kennedy's cabinet have one or more degrees from state universities, three of which are from land-grant colleges. In addition, the Secretary of the Army, the Chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, the head of the CIA, and the director of the United States Information Agency have all earned degrees at land-grant schools. The land-grant colleges have also contributed significantly to our military strength. The teaching of military tactics is one of the purposes of the 1862 Act, led to the establishment of an activity we all take for granted today, namely the Reserve Officers Training Corps, commonly known as the ROTC. Military leaders have repeatedly paid tribute to the ROTC program, which has, on the one hand, helped supply our soldier leaders, but, and possibly more important, also has proven to be important in the balance between the civilian and military control of our armed forces. The joint responsibility for military leadership that results from training in the military academies and in the land-grant colleges in parallel programs helped to assure that our military organization will not be taken over by any Prussian-style military general staff clique. Before concluding, I would like to make some specific observations concerning your own University of Alaska. Of course, you know even better than I the part played by Dr. Charles D. Bunnell, first president of the institution. Under Dr. Bunnell, the Alaska Agricultural Mechanical College, which opened in 1922 with six students, grew in size and prestige. One important milestone came on July 1st, 1935, when the college became the University of Alaska. I was very much impressed on reading the catalog to find that there is no tuition at the university for residents of Alaska. The availability of scholarships for the payment of dormitory rent helps extend the principle of education for all who have the ability, therefore, without regard to financial ability to pay. You are justifiably proud of your museum. I trust you will always be able to maintain it as a storehouse of knowledge pertaining to the entire history of Alaska. Other services which the university perform are of equal importance in the progress made and to be made. I refer to such things as the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Agricultural Extension Service, and the Biological Survey Experiment Station established in 1927 for the investigation of natural phenomena in the area. Yours is truly a university. I salute you and the tremendous strides you have made in 40 years. I know that your greatest contributions and the contributions of the state of Alaska are still ahead of you. But we know that you are here at the University of Alaska, and the other land-grant colleges and universities already have given to the United States in full measure for what you have received. Yes, instead of a giveaway, the United States Congress, with the approval of President Lincoln, made an investment that has paid handsome dividends. Let me assure you that the Congress of the United States will continue to support, with necessary authorization and appropriation, the type of work that has been done at this and other land-grant colleges and universities for as long as they keep moving forward in the frontiers of knowledge and learning. Here in Alaska, it is evident that the physical frontier and the educational frontier will be penetrated together and this great state enabled to develop to its fullest potential capacity. With you, we shall continue to invest in the future.
Kobuk, the Koyukuk, and the Kuskokwim. The Golden Heart tilts a little toward the south and west. The Porcupine, the Sheenjack, and the Chandalar. Headwaters to the east that prime the mighty Yukon. The Good Pasture, the Salcha, the Delta, the Wind, the Ambler, and the Colleen. The Tananaw, the Chinook. The Hooslia, the Charlie, the Squirrel, and the Chattanooga. Old glaciers are sleeping if the running is clear. The Copper, the Matanuska, the Golcana, the Good News, the Susitna, and the Rude. Waters flow south through the lofty range. The Uticoc, the Nome, the Pish, and the Noatak, where the land thrusts far to the north and west. The Colville, the Mead, and the Ikpikpuk. Majestic the Brooks leans down to the polar sea. The Iditarod, the King Salmon, the Mad, the Unalakleet, the Inoko, the Andriaske, bloodline of Denali. The Bethna, the Tatlawiksuk, and the Zitziana, the Taku, the Stikine, and the Boca de Quadra. The flow is tangled and troubled far to the south. These are the rivers of Alaska, these and many more. They are old friends to old Thomas. He has known them from the land and from the air, as he has known the great pathways of all the world. Lowell Thomas does not seek excitement. He takes it with him. It abides in the timbre of his voice, the intense far look in his eyes, the vibrant spring of his stride. Ever he's been the restless one, the roamer, the far wanderer. He is one to match the mountains and the rivers. Turbulent at times, confident, ever-seeking, exulting in the search. Of him, as of the great Ulysses, it might be said, he has become a name. For always roaming with a hungry heart, much has he seen and known. Cities of men and manners, climates, councils, government, himself not least, but honored of them all. Ever the explorer of ideas, of man's accomplishments, of the turn of the terrain of distant lands, the seven seas and the good air all around, Lowell Thomas, friend of Alaska, encouraging voice for the great land, true believer in what may come to be. Lowell Thomas, we salute you.
President Wood and friends, first I want to congratulate President Wood on his ability to stand here and speak with dignity while wearing his academic hat. I came out this morning with Dean Ray, and we had a flat tire halfway out, and we had to stop, and we were delayed putting on a new tire, and we got here after everyone else had been given out their academic robes and hats. And I got the last one, and I got one that was specially designed for Cap Lathrop. And I was delighted when Congressman Aspinwall spoke to you without wearing his, because I was wondering what under the sun I was going to do. I was afraid that I might be right in the middle of some serious words of advice to you, and suddenly it would go over on one eye. But apparently it's all right to put it to one side. I didn't want a third embarrassing incident in connection with this event. I'd already had two. The first was a month or so ago when I received a letter from a professor in Florida asking me if I would send him a copy of my commencement address at the University of Alaska. I was astounded that, in the first place, that they knew anything about what was going on in Alaska down in Florida. But that was the message. And I wrote back and explained to the professor that I never in my life had read a speech or written one. So it was hopeless. Then the second embarrassing incident came on Saturday. My wife and I, we were at the top of the Space Needle at the fair in Seattle. And I got a message from the office of the president of the fair that had been relayed from my office in New York, which was relaying it to me from the University of Alaska, from President Wood's, one of his assistants, Miss Hornbeck, I believe it is, and she was wiring, asking what my subject was going to be this morning. And until that moment, I hadn't thought about it. And we were up there at the top of the Space Needle, and as I looked out around, I thought, well, I'll send two words that come to my mind at the moment, and I did, far horizons. That seemed to be vague enough. I could talk on anything. And I was determined that I would do something about preparing a speech on the flight up here. But as so often is the case, that turned out to be not the place for it. And then yesterday I was listening to Dr. Armstrong's Baccalaureate and thought it was superb. And I particularly liked three words that he used that seemed to be his theme, men of compulsion. And I thought, well, I think I'll follow up that same theme. And that was my intention until I got here this morning. And then when I sat here on the stage, I changed my mind because I found myself sitting next to an inspiring man, and I am delighted and I congratulate you as well as congratulate him on receiving a degree today, one of the pioneers of aviation here in the North. So I thought, just as an indirect tribute to him, I'll not talk about him, but as an indirect tribute to him, that I would chat with you for a few moments about aviation and airmen whom I have known who've had something to do with Alaska. I might add, by the way, Congressman Aspinwall, that you are a much younger man than I am, and I come of the era when written speeches were unknown. So I never learned the technique. And you came, you're a much younger man, and of course, I don't know whether you are aware of this or not, but there was a time not so long ago when a written speech was virtually unknown. And the origin of the written speech came with the coming of the electronic era. And from the time that we had radio, nearly all people in public life began to write their speeches for an obvious reason. Often, this is not the case with the congressman this morning, of course, but often they had in mind not the live audience in front of them, but the possible audience that they might be reaching by the airwaves, and not wanting to take any risks, which is quite understandable too, all speeches from that time on have been written, virtually all. But I never learned that technique, and you may regret that. You at any rate are a live audience, and I'm only thinking about you. You may be in a coma before I conclude. I started coming to the north. By the way, President Wood wrote to me and suggested that I talk to you this morning about the old days in Alaska. And I think he did that because I was here in the winter and spoke about Sepala, who came north with us, the greatest of all the dog team drivers. And at that time, I told some stories of people I had known here in the north long years ago. And I presume that's the reason why he had asked me to do this. But I've changed my mind now, and we'll talk about something a little bit different. I've long been interested in aviation, and if you were to make a list of, say, the five most important flights in the history of man, I think your list should be as follows. First, the flight of Orville Wright, or the Wright brothers, at Kitty Hawk in 1903, man's first flight in heavier than air. Second, man's first flight around the planet, the circumnavigation of the globe. Third, man's first great flight in exploration. And Noel Wien, who is receiving a degree here today, played an important part in that, as I will explain in a moment. Fourth would be, I think, the breaking of the sound barrier by Major Chuck Yeager a few years ago. And then fifth, man's first orbit of the planet through space by Gagarin, if he was the one who made it. Perhaps I should stop and explain that for a moment, but this will be entirely off the record when I do explain it. Thursday night, I happened to share the platform with General MacArthur in New York. And just before we stepped up to the platform, an astronomer stopped and chatted with me, whom I had known for many years. And, of course, that happened to be the day of Scott Carpenter's flight. And nearly everyone was referring to it. And I spoke to the astronomer about it. And we talked about others. And he said to me that the Russians had at least two astronauts who are still up there and who've been there for a long time and who will be there much longer. And I asked him if he was sure about this, and he said yes, it was well known among people who were in a position to actually know that that was the case. I presume we never will know, but it was certainly an interesting remark to come from a source of that type. Well, to go back to these five flights, the first flight around the world, fame is a fickle thing, as you know. And there are not many people sitting here this morning who will remember the names of the first men to fly around the globe. It happened back a few years after the First World War. There was a race on. It was a natural race. All the nations in the world that at that time built airplanes became involved in the race to see which nation would have the honor of being the first to have an airman and a plane circumnavigate the planet. The British were in it, and the Dutch, Tony Fokker, one of his planes attempted it, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Italians, Caproni, and there was a Scandinavian plane or two. And the race had been going on for nearly 2 years before we got into it. And we finally entered the race simply because of a hard-driving airman in Washington who also had an Alaskan background, named General Billy Mitchell. And he kept hammering away at Washington for our people to get into this great race. And at last, after it had been on for nearly 2 years, why, America got into it. And the plane was designed by a young aircraft engineer who until then was virtually unknown. He had been an airplane designer for Glenn Martin in Cleveland, Ohio. But he had left Martin and had gone to the Pacific Coast and had set up his own small shop in Santa Monica. And he designed the plane that our people used for this flight around the world. His name, Donald Douglas, until then unknown and perhaps now the most famous name in the history of the manufacturing side in aviation. The Douglas cruisers, they were biplanes, open cockpit, powered by a single Liberty engine, cruising speed 70 miles an hour. And four of these planes were sent out to attempt this flight around the globe. Two men in each plane. The planes were named for American cities. The flagship was the Seattle, the Chicago, the New Orleans, and the Boston. The airmen who flew, I happen to know a little about it because I was historian of the first flight around the world. The commander of the flight was Major Fred Martin. In the cockpit with him, Sergeant Al Harvey. The others, Lowell Smith, Les Arnold, Eric Nelson, Jack Harding, Lee Wade, Hank Ogden. Their names now virtually forgotten. But when they came back from that flight, and they succeeded, incidentally, no other plane from any other country got farther than halfway around the world. But our airmen won the race, and it was one of the great triumphs in the history of man. It took them nearly 6 months to make the flight, from April 6th until September 28th. And over a month of that time, they spent in Alaska. They had bases, or at least made stops, at 7 points along the Alaskan coast, all the way from Seattle and Prince Rupert out to Attu. 5 weeks it was in all that they spent up here. And now, of course, that flight, it's 3,300 miles is the distance, is made by planes in less than a day. They flew on around the world. One plane crashed here in Alaska. One plane was lost in the North Atlantic, the Boston, went down between Scotland and Iceland. But a spare plane was flown out, so that the two airmen who had been in the Boston and who had gotten nearly all the way around were given a chance to fly in with the two planes that actually made it, the Seattle and the Chicago. And after they came back to the States, they were welcomed by millions and millions and millions of people who cheered them everywhere, because obviously the last lap of the flight was across North America. They had set forth from Santa Monica. Well, there's an argument today between Santa Monica and Seattle as to which was the starting point of the flight. Actually, there are monuments in each places, and each one says that that was where the first flight around the world began. There's one out at Lake Washington. You'll see it if you go down to Seattle. There's another one at Santa Monica. So they had to fly across the continent before the flight was entirely over. And they were greeted, cheered by millions and millions of people. And at that time, one of the most famous editors in American journalism was a man named Arthur Brisbane. And Arthur Brisbane stated in his column, he said, that hundreds and hundreds of years from now, perhaps thousands of years from now, when the names of all the presidents of the United States have vanished from history, he said, with the exception of two, Washington and Lincoln, he said, when they've all disappeared, because we know how rapidly names do vanish from history, just try and think back and make a list of people who were living 2,000 years ago. He said, when all these names have disappeared, excepting the names of two presidents, the names of these airmen will still be there. And he said the reason was because that was one of the major milestones in the history of man. Perhaps he was right, but in the meantime, they've been forgotten. And you could almost call them Alaskans. They stayed here so long. The most dramatic incident of the flight was here in the north. an area that Noel Wien, of course, and his sons, and many of you are familiar with, the Alaskan Peninsula, although it's not a part of the Wien domain, I believe. I think that's where Bob Reeves rules. I understand that Bob Reeves and another old friend of mine at this particular moment are down in the very area where this crash occurred on the Alaskan Peninsula, hunting bear. Bob Reeves and General Jimmy Doolittle are there today. The planes were flying on the lap from Seward to Dutch Harbor, and they got in mixed up with some of that notorious weather. And in those days when you could only go at 70 miles an hour, and the only instruments you had on your instrument board were a compass and your fuel gauges and your turn and bank indicator, that was all, I believe, why, they couldn't fly above the weather. And the leader of the flight, Major Martin, in the Seattle, got lost. And he had some difficulty, and he came down at a cannery at Chignik. The others went on to Dutch Harbor, and they waited and waited. Major Martin and Sergeant Harvey started on the next day to try and overtake them, but this time they had even more difficulty. They slammed into a mountain, or rather into the top of a high ridge between Chignik and Dutch Harbor. They didn't know where they were. No one did, because their radio was not working. They found themselves on top of this high ridge where they couldn't see because it was ceiling zero, in deep spring snow, which is rather difficult to travel in. Noel Wien is an expert on that, he having spent 6 days, the second year he was up here, making his way out from a crash down near Nenana. Well, Washington, not knowing where they were, assumed that the two were probably dead. So Washington wired Dutch Harbor for the other three planes to fly on, and they did. 12 days later, Martin and Harvey stumbled through the deep spring snow out on Bering Sea at Bristol Bay on the other side of the peninsula. They'd made their way all the way across, not knowing where they were. They came out at one of Nick Bez's canneries. And eventually, of course, they came outside. And they were very quickly forgotten because the other three planes went on with the flight. When Dr. Armstrong was speaking about men of compulsion yesterday morning in the baccalaureate, I couldn't help think about these young airmen. And I would use a different term, but it means the same thing, I suppose. All my life, I have particularly enjoyed being exposed to the contagion of men of triumphant spirit. And I think that my first real exposure, well, not exactly, but the first time that I was fully aware of it, was when I first came north to Alaska those 48 years ago. And when I rubbed shoulders with the picturesque Alaskans of that day, journeyed out over the trails with General Dick Richardson, who was Colonel Dick Richardson in those days, who laid out the trails of Alaska, now the Richardson Highway named for him. Colonel Dick Richardson was indeed a man of triumphant spirit, but it seemed to me at that particular moment that spirits were about to triumph over the colonel. However, he must have shaken that off. He weighed about 300 pounds, the colonel did. And I've never forgotten one day out on Prince William Sound. We were crossing Prince William Sound, and this morning when we were coming out here, Dr. Ray was telling me that perhaps the highest waves in the world had been encountered on Prince William Sound, the Gulf of Alaska. And I mentioned to him that I had encountered a few of them, and those that I remember most vividly, when we were in a small fishing vessel, and Colonel Richardson was with me, 300 pounds of him, and these high waves for which that area is so famous, well, the colonel, he toppled over, and it took us about 30 minutes to get him up off the floor. And that was what I meant by saying that perhaps the spirits were about to triumph over him. But I think he must have shaken that off, because a little bit later on, Uncle Sam put him in charge of the top command of one of our armies invading the north of Europe by way of Archangel. And then I mentioned to you another flight, and I have never known a man of more triumphant spirit than this. You might almost call him an Alaskan, because he was here so long. And he was the man who made the second great flight that I refer to, or the third rather, the first one of any major importance in the history of aviation and exploration. This young man, the last book that I happened to write was his biography. And I encountered him in an odd way. My wife and I, after the First World War, I was involved in a speaking tour of the world, and we were invited to come out to Australia. And we were invited by the Prime Minister and his cabinet to a function. And at this affair, where we were the guests of honor, sitting across from me, beside the Prime Minister, was the Commander-in-Chief of the Australian Armies in World War I. He must have been a man of triumphant spirit, but I only knew him casually. I was always astounded by the fact that the Australians had selected him as their Commander-in-Chief in World War I, because you will remember that the Allies of that war were fighting against armies that were led by the German Kaiser. And the Commander-in-Chief of the Australian Army in World War I was a German Jew named Sir John Monash. Certainly a great tribute to the Australians and to Monash. He was an engineer before he became a soldier. And as we sat there at the table, we were talking about some of the unusual men of World War I. And in those days, I was telling the story of the Eastern campaigns. I had been lucky enough to be the only person to bring back the combined story of two of the campaigns in the East, the campaign that freed the Holy Land from the Turks. I was with Allenby's army, and then I was fortunate enough to be the only observer with the Arabian army that was led by that incredible figure, Lawrence of Arabia. And we were chatting at the luncheon about Lawrence, and I turned to Sir John Monash and asked him if in his Australian forces he had ever thought about it, if there was any one person that stood out from all the others in his vast army. And he said, yes, he thought so. And he had even mentioned the name of this soldier in the first edition of his memoirs. And he said it caused so much of a hullabaloo in Australia, his mentioning this man, that he omitted it in the second edition and all succeeding ones. He said it had been a tradition until then for a commander-in-chief of armies to not mention individuals below the rank of general officer, for rather obvious reasons, because if you would mention a private or a lieutenant or a captain or a major or even a colonel, where would you stop? There would be so many who would be outstanding. But he said that he had mentioned one man, and I asked him to tell me about him, and he said his name was Captain George Hubert Wilkins. And then he told me a little of the story of Wilkins. And I'll not go into that in detail now, but I'll come down to the time when Noel Ween played a vital part in it all. Sir John Monash told me, incidentally, that Wilkins had been an explorer in the Arctic, in northern Alaska, that he had been with Stephenson on an expedition. The war was going on for more than a year before Wilkins in the Arctic even knew that there was a war going on. When he got the message, he came outside. Took him a distance of some 35,000 miles to get into action, but once he got into action, the Commander-in-Chief of the Australian Army told me that Wilkins was in every single action that the Australian forces took part in from that time on. And he said he was fantastic, what he did. And then he went on with exploration. And not very long after the First World War, he came back to Alaska. As some of you who live here in Fairbanks undoubtedly saw one or two or more of Wilkins' planes crash out here at the airfield. And then his great ambition in that period was to